Chapter 8. Fermenting Grains and Starchy Tubers. Grains and starchy tubers are the most basic daily staples that sustain most of humanity, filling our bellies and fulfilling our caloric requirements, embellished and supplemented when possible by vegetables, fruit, meat and fish, cheese, beans, and all the rest. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, the most important cereal grains, in order of quantities grown and consumed globally by both humans and our farm animals, are corn, maize, wheat, rice, barley, sorghum, millet, oats, and rye. The most important starchy tubers are potatoes, cassava, sweet potatoes, yams, and taro. The emergence of grain agriculture gave rise to the earliest empires. The stability and storability of dry grains made possible unprecedented potential for accumulating wealth and building political power. The emergence of complex societies, the need to keep written records, and the popularity of beer all followed from the surplus of grain, writes Tom Standage in A History of the World in Six Glasses. Grains continue to be of great economic, social, and political importance. Failures of grain crops have toppled governments and sparked revolutions. The same dense, dry quality that makes grains so stable for storage also makes them difficult to digest. To nourish us well, they need the pre-digestion of fermentation. Grains contain several types of anti-nutrients that inhibit their digestion, including a form of phosphorus called phytic acid. According to an article in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry, phytic acid and its derivatives can bind essential dietary minerals, thus making them unavailable or only partially available for absorption. Phytic acid reduces the availability of minerals not only in the food that contains the phytic acid, but also in other foods being digested at the same time. Fermentation transforms phytic acid, as well as other toxic compounds found in grains, thereby neutralizing their harmful effects. In grains, bacterial fermentation also increases the bioavailability of the amino acid lysine. The pre-digestion power of fermentation is even more pronounced with cassava, a starchy tuber that is an important staple crop in many tropical regions. Cassava frequently contains a chemical precursor to cyanide, hydrocyanic acid, and can be quite poisonous if consumed unprocessed. As with phytic acid in the grains, fermentation reduces or eliminates the root's toxicity. The miracle is that without knowing the chemistry of any of this, our ancestors intuitively understood or observed that grains and cassava roots need to be soaked, which initiates microbial activity, in order to be nutritious and easily digested. Ingrained patterns. There is incredible variety in the particulars of regional styles of fermenting staple grains and starchy tubers around the world. And yet, looking across cultures, there are also recurring patterns of how different grains and tubers are fermented and prepared in different places. They are soaked. Often they are milled or pounded. Frequently, grains are sprouted, also known as malted, prior to fermentation. This breaks down complex carbohydrates into simple sugars. In other traditions, molds are grown on grains, or sometimes the grains are chewed, in order to accomplish the same enzymatic transformation. Grains are cooked into stiff porridges and/or thin gruels. They are fried as flatbreads or pancakes, steamed or baked as loaves. Nixtamalization. Nixtamalization is a process that emerged in the corn-centered cultures of Central America. The word is adapted from the Aztec Nahuatl language. In its vast geographic diffusion, there is considerable variation in the details of how this process is carried out. This is how I nixtamalize corn. I do it using hardwood ash because that is a constant presence in my life. Most contemporary directions make use of hydrated lime, calcium hydroxide, widely available in Mexican markets as cal. For 2 pounds or 1 kilogram of dried whole kernel corn, use 1 cup or 250 milliliters of sifted wood ash or 1 tablespoon or 15 milliliters cal. Bring the water with corn to a boil. Add wood ash mixed with water, or cal dissolved in water, to the boiling corn. The corn will turn bright orange immediately. Gently simmer for about 15 minutes or until the skins begin to loosen from the kernels. If you cook longer, the skins, and eventually the entire kernels, will dissolve. I've used too much ash, left the nixtamal boiling too long, and had the corn completely dissolve into the solution. Once the skins are separating from the kernels, remove the pot from the heat, cover, and leave the corn to sit in the hot alkaline solution overnight or until cool. Rinse well. If the skins are still attached to corn, rub between the palms of your hands to remove. The corn is now nixtamal. One grain with an impressive array of variations in its fermentation styles, exemplifying patterns found across cultures, is corn, known in much of the English-speaking world as maize. This grain is native to Mexico, where it is fermented into myriad foods and drinks. In ancient as well as contemporary Mexican ferments, in most cases, unless the corn is to be sprouted, corn is nixtamalized, an alkalinizing process in which whole corn kernels are cooked with wood ash or lime. This process removes the hard outer layer of the kernel, alters the flavor, and improves the nutritional value of the corn. Descendants of the Mayan civilization that arose around corn fermented by coarsely crushing the freshly nixtamalized corn into a stiff dough, masa, then forming it into balls, without any starter, and wrapping the corn dough balls in banana or other large leaves. You can also wrap it in corn husks, like tamales. These balls are fermented several days or longer. Historian Sophie D. Coe cites reports on Mayan life by an early Spanish bishop of the Yucatan, Diego de Landa, that great balls of this dough are given to travelers and that it lasts for months merely becoming sour. This fermented dough is called pozol. Often, molds develop on its surfaces as it ages. It is possible that this surface mycoflora contributes to flavor, and, hence, the traditional style pozol dough might be viewed as a fungal-ripened, lactic-fermented product, observe a team of microbiologists, which would make it analogous to cheeses and the mixed mold grain cultures of China and elsewhere in Asia. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization reports that bits of pozol, at various stages of the fermentation process, are mixed with water at proportions ranging between 1 to 2 and 1 to 3. Salt, chili peppers, sugar, or honey is added to produce a whitish porridge which is consumed in the uncooked state as a basic food in the daily diet of large communities. Pozol is convenient and easy, a restorative beverage in the field or on the road. Pozol is not to be confused with the whole corn stew pozole, though that too can be made with fermented corn. Pozol is consumed by Indian and mestizo populations, mainly in the southeastern states of Mexico. Atole is another ancient corn-based beverage often fermented, known as atole in Spanish. Atole is corn cooked into a thin drinkable gruel. Diego de Landa describes its importance among the Maya at the time of the arrival of the Spanish. From the most finely ground maize, they extract a milk which they thicken over the fire to make into a kind of porridge, which they drink hot in the morning. They throw water on what is left over from the morning and drink it during the day because they are not accustomed to drink water on its own. They also toast and grind the maize and dilute it with a little pepper and cacao, which makes a most refreshing drink. From the ground maize and cacao, they make a foaming drink with which they celebrate their feasts. They extract from cacao a grease which resembles butter, and from this and from the maize they make another drink which is both tasty and highly regarded. Atole is thought to be among the earliest cacao vehicles. Sophie Coe reports that the Aztecs often left atole to sour for 4 or 5 days, until it developed an agreeable sourness, into zoco etole. Atole could be soured during many points in its preparation, writes Coe. One method was to soak the hard, ripe maize, without adding lime, for many days until it almost dissolved of its own accord. Alternatively, it could be soaked, ground, and then left to sour before boiling. Souring could also take place after grinding and dilution. One recipe divides the ground maize dough, mixed with water, into 2 equal portions, one of which is boiled and then added to the unboiled portion and left to stand overnight. The next day, the mixture is boiled again. Even young maize etole could be soured. In Spanish, zoco etole is known as atole agrio, sour atole. More on this ahead. A completely different microbial transformation of corn enjoyed in Mexico is huitlacoche, corn on which the fungus Eustilago maidus has grown, known in English as corn smut. The fungus appears in growing plants and is pathogenic to the plant. Kernels in infected ears of corn develop into enlarged and irregular spongy black masses known as galls. Aztec and later Mexican cuisine came to celebrate the distinctive flavor of the fungus-blackened corn, so much so that the fungus is often deliberately introduced. In parts of Mexico, especially among Huichol and Tarahumar peoples, corn is also fermented into a beer called tezguino. To make tezguino, corn is first sprouted, also known as malting, during which enzymes develop to digest complex carbohydrates into simple sugars. Then the sprouted corn is ground into a paste, which is simmered with water for about 12 hours or more, then cooled before adding various botanical catalysts and fermenting. Malted corn is also fermented with hot chili peppers into a beer called sindecho by the Mazahua people of central Mexico. A very different process of making beer from corn, called chicha, is practiced in the Andes Mountains of South America. The source of enzymes to break down complex carbohydrates into simple sugars is saliva. The corn is chewed to crush the kernels and saturate them with the salivary enzymes that initiate this conversion. In Brazil, soaked whole corn kernels are ground, mixed with water, sugar, and sometimes fruit, ginger, or other spices, and fermented into a light beverage called aluá. Cherokee people ferment corn into a sour beverage called gunohena, essentially like tezguino, only with the corn nixtamalized rather than sprouted. In Zuni breadstuff, author Frank Hamilton Cushing, who lived among the Zuni people in the 1870s and 1880s, describes the most prized leaven as chewed corn, mixed with moderately fine meal and warm water and placed in little narrow-necked pots over or near the hearth until fermentation took place, when lime, treated corn, flour, masa, and a little salt were added, resulting in a yeast in no wise inferior to some of our own. Cushing describes a range of Zuni fermented corn products made with such yeasts, including dumplings, puddings, batter cakes, and fire loaves. In the southeastern U.S. region of Appalachia, people pickle corn on or off the cob in brine. Ernest Parker of Gilmer County, Georgia, recalls that in his youth, they'd brine pickle barrels of whole ears of corn just like they pickled kraut and beans. April McGregor, who makes and sells Appalachian soured corn and many other ferments and preserves, as Farmer's Daughter Bread, is the one who first introduced me to this idea of brine pickling corn. I always thought that sour corn was the European tradition of sour cabbage brought over and applied to local ingredients, explains April. But after talking to a Cherokee folklorist, she came to understand that sour corn was already a Native American tradition that Europeans raised on sour cabbage had a taste for. April recommends using fresh sweet corn in 5% brine, roughly 3 tablespoons of salt per quart/liter of water, spiced with peppercorns. For starchier field corn, she recommends boiling the corn for a minute in order to set the milk. Because sweet corn is so sugary and it ripens in hot weather, it sours fast. Sour corn can be served still on the cob as a pickle, as a relish, mixed into salsas, or incorporated into a range of salads or cooked dishes. Maori Kanga Wai. Blogger Chef Talleyrand. This literally translates as corn water, but means a water-cured corn dish. Maori food has its roots in their tradition, culture, and also out of necessity, making use of foods readily available, in season, or finding ways of preserving them for future use. Kanga Wai certainly comes under the latter. It is also known as rotten corn. It has a very strong and unpleasant smell to it, which if you can get past, and most non-Maori can't, is not a totally unpleasant flavor. Originally, the shelled white corn was placed in flour sacks and tied to stakes in running streams, but these days it is more often than not just placed into a drum of water and the water changed daily for 2 months. By then the corn is really soft and mushy, not to mention smelling very ripe. This is then cleaned, mashed, or minced. 2 parts corn to 6 parts water is then simmered on the stove until a porridge/grits/oatmeal type dish is produced, best done outdoors or with the windows open very wide. This is then served with cream and sugar added to taste. A baked custard is also made with it by adding cream, eggs, and sugar to the kanga wai and baking in the oven. If you are ever game to try it, bon appetit. Corn and styles of fermenting it have migrated far from the cultivated grain's early range in the Americas. Maori people in New Zealand ferment corn and water in a process they call ganga wai. Maize cobs can be kept in water for weeks for this ferment, writes Bill Mollison. Kernels may be mixed with grated sweet potato and steamed in muslin or corn leaves for about an hour. Salt and pepper or butter, sugar, and milk can be added to taste. The grains may be fried with salt and pork fat or made into gruel. Across Africa, porridges and beverages made from corn have been subsistence staples. Ogi, Nigeria, and Uji, Kenya, are sour porridges made of corn, millet, or other grains. The hot porridge is also known as pap, while the solidified form that results when the porridge is cooled is known as agidi. Kenki is a Ghanaian ferment, something like tamales, in which corn is soaked a day or two, ground into a paste, and fermented a few days. Then half of it is cooked into a porridge, which, after it cools, is mixed with the uncooked portion, formed into balls, wrapped in corn husks or plantain leaves, and steamed. Mahewu is a sour fermented corn beverage widely enjoyed in southern Africa. Mix 1 part cornmeal with 9 parts boiling water, and cook the mixture about 10 minutes until it begins to thicken. After it cools, mix in wheat flour, about 5% of the amount of cornmeal used, which functions as a live starter. Transfer to a fermentation vessel and leave in a warm spot to ferment. Reportedly in southern Africa, mahewu is typically fermented about 24 hours. In Tennessee, I had to wait several days before mine developed some flavor, which was mild and pleasant. Stir and taste each day to gauge progress. Fermented corn has many other names and forms across Africa. Of course, contemporary American corn dishes, such as cornbread and grits, can be fermented by simple soaking, as can Italian polenta. There is no food or drink made from corn or any other grain that cannot be fermented. One further form of corn fermentation worthy of mention is moonshine, also known as corn whiskey. Whiskey is distilled to concentrate alcohol, but distillation can only concentrate the alcohol that is formed by fermentation. Moonshine has been in the news in the rural county where I live in Tennessee because voters just approved a referendum to legalize whiskey making here. What is most interesting to me is the history that has come to light. Before Prohibition, 18 distilleries were licensed to operate in our small county. They provided a market for local farmers' corn and a non-perishable agricultural product to export out of the county to bring money in. After Prohibition and the locally imposed prohibition that has ensued, our county never found another viable economic foundation. Perhaps this fermentation-dependent, value-adding activity will once again flourish here, sustaining farmers, creating jobs, and helping to revive the moribund local economy. Wherever it is spread, corn has been of great importance, giving rise, or new expression, to elaborate cultural practices, different everywhere and yet with recurrent patterns. All these ferments grow out of the same spirit of creative collaboration with life forces that give rise to the seed itself. 7,000 years of concentrated energy emanate from the seed, writes Marilu Awiakta in Selu, explaining the sacredness of corn and its powerful spirituality. We can feel that energy with our hands, and take a quantum leap out of linear time and into a warm, wet place in Mexico where indigenous people are having a similar experience as, for the first time, they touch a certain wild grass. Beyond that mythical moment of original contact, Awiakta invites us to visualize the collaborative journey that has unfolded since between this plant and its human cultivators. Under their reverent, patient care, the wild seed gradually relinquishes its protective husk and entrusts its reproductive life to human hands, a process that the people interpret according to their sacred law and covenant with Mother Earth. Respectful care brings abundance. Lack of care brings nothing. If you take, you must give back. Return the gift. The people keep the covenant. From the seed they develop infinite varieties of what is now called the supreme achievement in plant domestication of all time. From the spirit, the nature of corn, the people learn survival wisdoms, common sense ways of living in harmony with their environment and with each other. To revere the spirit and convey the wisdoms, each tribe, according to its customs, creates ceremonies, rituals, songs, art, and stories. Each story is itself a seed, where the spirit of corn, as well as her basic teachings, is concentrated. Planted in a child's mind, the story matures along with the child, nourishing her or him to grow in wisdom and in stature. Story and life interweave. An important part of corn's story is not only how it has been cultivated, but also how it has been processed and fermented. Reclaiming our food involves investigating, learning, and ultimately retelling our stories. Wheat has its own stories and continuum of traditional fermentation styles, as do rice, rye, and all the other grains. And every one of the styles of fermenting corn could be adapted to other grains. The results would be different, of course, because each of the grains is so distinctive in its nature, texture, biochemistry, and flavor. But the grain ferments all follow just a few basic patterns, all permutations and elaborations of the simple mixing of water with grains. Grains can be combined with water in so many different ways, and every one of them can be enhanced by fermentation. Incognito's Manifesto. We are not gluten and lactose intolerant. Wheat is not the problem. It's the bloody cooks. Given just a tad more T-I-M-E and tending via culinary practices which stimulate the innate enzyme activity, unwanted naturally occurring anti-nutrients are neutralized, and the gluten, a splendid complex vegetable protein, transforms to become easily digestible. When food preparation is rushed, as is the case with 99% of all modern food, and in particular with bread, that some unconverted gluten, and also carbohydrate, bestows a toxic, allergenic effect upon the human body. Predigestion is essential for body harmony. Since the 1950s, we have lost the thread connecting us to an ancient culinary tradition that is essential in disabling the toxic anti-nutrients in food, and rendering proteins, carbohydrates, malts, etc., not only harmless, but also maximally digestible, nutritious, and delicious. The missing traditional process is fermentation, its lost habitat, the slow kitchen. And if that isn't enough anguish, we are also being heavily harmed, conned, and dumbed down by a heartless and profit-rapacious medical-slash-pharmaceutical illness industry and its partners in crime, the food biz cartels, that help create and continue the sickness, and acquiescent government-regulating bodies that are supposed to protect us from such vultures. Soaking grains. The simplest way to ferment grains is to soak them. Water is the source of all life, and the dry seed is able to persist intact precisely because, in the absence of available water, the microbes inevitably present on the surface of it cannot function or grow. Yet they do remain dormant until restored to life by water, much like the seed itself. When you soak the grain, it begins to swell, setting in motion a series of changes that, given the right conditions, will result in its sprouting into a new plant. At the same time, water also revives the bacteria and fungi that populate the grain's surfaces and initiate fermentation. Grains benefit from soaking whether whole or already milled. Here we are addressing whole and partially milled grains such as cracked wheat or rolled oats. Flour will be addressed later. Use dechlorinated water in whatever proportion you wish to use for cooking the grains. You can soak grains for just a few hours if that's all you have, although predigestion will just be getting underway. It's better than not soaking at all. More predigestion will occur faster if you soak grains in warm, body temperature, water, and add some active live cultures, such as a little soaking liquid saved from a previous soak, whey, sourdough starter, buttermilk, or sauerkraut juice, or acids such as vinegar or lemon juice. Soak 8 to 12 hours for grains to fully swell, or you can soak for a day or several days to allow for a fuller predigestion and really develop flavor. If you get into a rhythm of this, I recommend saving a few cups of the soaking liquid each time to jumpstart the next soak. Soaking is easy. It does not actually take any extra work, just a little planning. There are different schools of thought as to whether to cook grains in their soaking water or discard the soaking water and replace it with fresh. I do not have a definitive answer to this question. In my own practice, I use the water from longer soakings. More nutrients have leached into this soaking water, and it has developed flavor. With shorter soaks, I often pour off unabsorbed soaking water and replace it with the same volume of fresh. Paul Pitchford, in Healing with Whole Foods, states clearly, "Discard soak water." However, he gives no reason. Jessica Porter, author of The Hip Chick's Guide to Macrobiotics, and Aveline Cushy, author of The Complete Guide to Macrobiotic Cooking, both direct us in recipes to cook grains in soaking water, but neither includes any discussion of the issue. Sally Fallon Morrell, who has gotten many people soaking their grains via her book, Nourishing Traditions, does not specify in the book whether there is any reason not to use the soaking water. When I emailed her to ask, she replied, "Normally I drain the grains, but with oatmeal I do cook with the soaking water." Like me, she is inconsistent, sometimes discarding soaking water, sometimes using it. There is not an ultimate answer to everything. Sprouting. Although soaking is the first step in sprouting, grains or other seeds cannot sprout if left soaking. Germination, which is what sprouting is, requires water, but it also requires oxygen. Soaked seeds will swell and then ferment, but they will not germinate unless the water is drained from them. Therefore, to sprout whole grains or other seeds, only intact, unmilled seeds can generally germinate, soak them for 8 to 24 hours, then drain the water off. For sprouting, I typically soak seeds in a jar, no more than a quarter full, with a piece of vinyl window screening covering the top, held in place by a rubber band. After soaking, I simply pour the excess water off, then leave the jar inverted, sitting in the dish rack or in a measuring cup or bowl, elevated so that the grains do not sit in the draining water. Fermenter Nancy Henderson suggests using nylon stockings for sprouting. Cheaper than jars, takes less room, easier to handle, and yields a better result. Just soak overnight as usual, then pour into the stockings and drape over something like the kitchen faucet. Whichever system you use, keep grains moist by rinsing them at least twice a day, morning and night, or more frequently in summer heat, then draining well each time. The length of time required for sprouting will vary with the specific grain, as well as temperature and frequency of rinsing. Keep sprouting grains protected from sunlight to prevent photosynthesis and the development of bitter flavor. As a general rule of thumb, grain sprouts are ready when the white tails grow to be about the length of the grain itself. Sprouted grains can be used fresh in any kind of dough or batter, or beverages such as Rejuvelac or Tesguino, or they may be dried in a dehydrator under the sun or in a low oven for beer brewing or milling into flour. Rejuvelac. Rejuvelac is a tonic beverage made by fermenting already sprouted grains in water. To make Rejuvelac, you need to first sprout your grains. After they have sprouted, cover them with water. Ferment them for a day or two, then strain off the liquid and enjoy. Store Rejuvelac in the refrigerator. Cover grains with more water for a second pressing, if desired. Rejuvelac was developed by Ann Wigmore, a raw food pioneer of the 1960s. Some people love its flavor, others find it unappealing. Many people have also reported success using Rejuvelac as a starter for other types of ferments. Porridges. Before anyone was making bread as we know it from cereal grains, they were making porridges and gruels. These are just simpler and more straightforward to make. Gruels are thin and runny, usually drunk. Porridges are thicker, typically eaten from a bowl with a spoon, or in some cases thick enough to pick up with fingers and dip into stews. But they both exist along a continuum, and it would be hard to say exactly where gruel ends and porridge begins. Porridge is my more common experience, but any porridge can be thinned into gruel by adding more water. Fermentation improves the flavor of porridges and gruels and enhances their digestibility and nutrient availability. The porridge-gruel continuum is powerful comfort food. I lovingly recall my grandmother always making cream of wheat for my siblings and me whenever we were with her. Gruel is notable for being the first food most of humanity eats as infants, transitioning from nursing. All traditional weaning foods tend to be in the form of a gruel made from the local staple, states the Journal of Tropical Pediatrics. Infants are at the peak of their vulnerability to illness and death during the weaning period due to the potential for malnutrition and diarrheal infections. Fermentation of weaning gruels, traditional in many regions of the world, increases nutrient density of gruels, improves nutrient availability, protects gruels from bacterial contamination, and can help build the microbial ecology of the infants who eat them. These benefits have been shown to decrease illness and mortality in infants. In the United States, porridges have become a vehicle for sweetening with maple syrup, honey, sugar, or high fructose corn syrup. I encourage listeners to experiment with savory seasoning of porridges. I grew up eating porridge with butter, salt, and pepper, which my father, descended from Lithuanian Jews, described as the Litvak way. Nowadays, I usually season porridges with butter, peanut butter, miso, and garlic, all together. If you are a condiment lover, as I am, and as I believe most people are, let your porridge base serve as a vehicle for your favorite condiments, and don't be afraid of bold experimentation. Fermenting oatmeal. To ferment oatmeal, soak rolled or steel-cut oats in 2 to 3 times their volume of water. 2 parts water will make thick oatmeal, 3 parts will result in a creamier and runnier product. Soak overnight or for 24 hours or a few days, stirring occasionally. Then gently bring the oats and soaking water with a pinch of salt to a boil and simmer, stirring until all the water has absorbed into the oats and the oatmeal reaches a homogeneous consistency. If the oatmeal seems too thick, adjust by adding water, just a little at a time. If it seems too thin, add a little more oats. That's about how easy fermented porridge is. In Brittany, oat porridge was formerly eaten after one night of fermentation, writes Claude Aubert. This overnight fermentation gives the traditional dish its characteristic taste, slightly acid, that one seeks in vain in modern porridges. With soaking, you can even do this with whole oats, though they need to cook longer. Sometimes in winter, I've boiled soaked whole oats at night, then left them warming on a trivet atop the damped-down wood stove. The whole groat oatmeal, slow-cooked all night, is incomparably creamy and delicious. My friend Brett Guadagnino, a baker in New Orleans, uses sourdough starter to ferment oats and soaks them in milk rather than water. I add a scant teaspoon of culture to a big mason jar of oats and milk, he writes. The trick is to time it right so that it isn't too sour by breakfast time. Ideally, the mixture thickens and acquires a cheese-like consistency and flavor. It tastes great as a lightly sweetened or savory breakfast. Brett also uses this sourdough oatmeal in a novel way as a thickener for stews. Dan Leppard, who writes about bread for the UK's Guardian, sent me a recipe for a porridge called Suins from a 1929 cookbook, The Scots Kitchen, its traditions and lore with old-time recipes. Suins is made from sids, the inner husks of oat grains, which still have some starch attached after they are removed from the oats. First, the sids are soaked for 4 days or longer, then they are strained through a sieve. Squeeze the sids to get all the goodness out of them, adding a little more cold water in the process, advises the author, F. Marion McNeil. The sids themselves are then discarded, and the soaking liquid is left to stand for another day, during which starch from the sids sinks and accumulates at the bottom. When required for use, the clear liquor is poured off and some of the sediment is put into a pan with water. Add a little salt and boil it for 10 minutes or more, stirring it briskly until it thickens. Here, fermentation is a means of gleaning residual starch that would otherwise be discarded. Grits/polenta. Grits are the corn porridge of the contemporary southeastern United States. Growing up in New York, I knew grits only as an obscure cultural reference, as in Flo sassing DeMel on the 1970s television comedy Alice, "Kiss my grits." But I was familiar with polenta, the Italian corn porridge casserole, which I love to eat and occasionally prepare. Once I moved to Tennessee, I was exposed to grits, and cheesy, spicy grits with fried eggs became part of my breakfast repertoire. And as I made grits and polenta, I pondered the differences between them. Grits are usually, but not always, described as hominy grits. Hominy is an English word, adopted from the Algonquian, for corn that has been lime processed, which I discussed briefly earlier as nixtamalization, an anglicized version of an Aztec word. Grits just means a coarse grind, and hominy grits specifies that it be of hominy corn. In contrast, polenta is typically milled from corn that has not undergone this process, as the Europeans did not import the indigenous foodways along with the corn itself. But other than this distinction, whether or not the corn was nixtamalized, polenta and grits are exactly the same thing, coarse grinds of corn. Millet polenta. Lisa. My family grew up in the northern Italian Dolomites. In the cold winter months, we often ate polenta, which is coarsely ground cornmeal cooked into porridge. We served it with cheese and buttermilk made by our farmer neighbors. Since I do not eat as much dairy anymore, I have experimented with other grains that can mimic the flavor of those toppings. I have discovered that a delicious version of this dish can be made with millet. Try it out and enjoy the richness of this fermented cereal grain. Pour 1/4 cup, 50 milliliters, millet into a quart mason jar. Then add 2 teaspoons, 10 milliliters, salt, and fill to the rim with water. Cover the jar with cheesecloth and let sit in a warm place for 24 hours to 2 days. Strain and rinse the millet, then pour into a cooking pot with 1 1/2 cups, 350 milliliters, water. Bring to a boil, then reduce to a simmer. Optional, add 1 teaspoon or 5 milliliters each oregano, turmeric, cumin, paprika, salt. Simmer until the millet begins to thicken, about 20 minutes. Begin to stir occasionally as though you were cooking oatmeal. Add 3 tablespoons, 45 milliliters, olive oil, and 1 tablespoon, 15 milliliters, lemon juice, optional. Cook on low heat and stir occasionally until the millet reaches a thick consistency. Pour into an 8x8 inch, 20x20 centimeter, container, or something similarly sized, and allow to cool. Finally, slice and serve toasted, grilled, or as it is. Either can be fermented the same way. Soak it, with any kind of starter if you have one, or not, overnight, for a day or two, or even longer. This soak will make your grits or polenta creamier, more digestible, and more delicious. After soaking, cook with water and a pinch of salt, and keep stirring to break up clumps and prevent burning on the bottom. I like to keep a kettle of hot water on hand to add hot water as needed. Both grits and polenta can be served runny or set. Whatever consistency the dish has while hot, it thickens as it cools. Like ogi, Nigerian fermented corn porridge, briefly touched upon earlier, which is called pap as a hot porridge and agidi after it is cooled and solidified. I usually make enough grits to enjoy some hot and thick but still stirrable. Then spread leftover in a pie tin or baking pan to cool. After it sets, I slice and fry. Yum! You can also make corn porridge directly from soaked whole corn kernels by pounding the kernels of dehulled, nixtamalized corn into a paste with a mortar and pestle, or grinding it in a food processor or grain grinder. Note that if you mill wet grains in a grinder, it is imperative that you thoroughly clean and dry the grinder afterward to prevent rusting. If you wish to ferment, let it ferment a day or two as a paste with nutrients available to the microbes. Then bring the corn paste to a boil with a little salt and more water, stirring constantly, and cook until the desired consistency is reached, adding hot water as necessary. Atole agrio. Atole is a thin corn gruel, typically drunk as a beverage. According to Diana Kennedy, author of numerous books about Mexican cuisine, it is a gruel of corn masa, traditionally prepared with dried corn that has been barely cooked, without lime, and ground to a fine masa. It is served hot or cold, sweetened or seasoned, with a variety of ingredients, depending on the local custom. One style of atole is atole agrio, which is soured atole. Kennedy reports on the atole agrio process of Señora Blanca Flores in Huautla de Jiménez, who begins by soaking corn in water on a ceramic pot for 4 days, which by then had begun to sour. Then the uncooked corn is rinsed, ground to a fine masa, and left to sour another day. Finally, the masa is diluted with water, strained to remove the coarsest pieces, cooked into atole, and served. I followed Señora Flores' process and love the result, very smooth and satisfying in its unembellished simplicity, though it could be embellished in so many different ways, sweet, savory, and/or spicy. I ground the soaked corn kernels in my hand-cranked Corona mill, then cleaned and dried it thoroughly, and added enough water to make a workable paste. After another day's fermentation, I added more water to produce a slurry and strained it through a wire strainer. Then I poured a little more water through the residue and pressed out as much starchy liquid as I could. I transferred the smooth, starchy corn water to a pot and brought it to a gentle boil, stirring constantly to prevent burning. It firms right up as it cooks, just keep adding hot water. A pinch of salt brought out the flavor of the soured corn. Once I thought I had achieved the right thin gruel consistency, I removed the pot from the heat and let it cool, since I wanted to drink the atole cold in the summer heat. By the time it cooled, it solidified into a smooth corn pudding, which was lovely, but not the consistency I was going for. So I reheated the atole, adding more water, and stirred until it once again achieved a homogeneous consistency, this time thinner. Porridges and gruels are very versatile and can be cooked to a wide range of consistencies. Millet porridge. You can make porridge with any grain. Personally, I love to eat porridge of fermented millet. Millet itself has a very mild, sweet flavor, and fermentation contributes flavor complexity. To make millet porridge, coarsely grind millet and soak it for a day or two before cooking. Alternatively, soak millet for a day or two, then grind it, then ferment another day or two as a paste. Cook millet with water and salt into porridge using a proportion of around 4 parts water to 1 part grain. Generally, I don't measure. I keep a kettle of hot water at the ready so I can add more hot water as the porridge thickens. People are often shocked at how creamy fermented millet porridge is. If they are familiar with millet at all, they think of it as dry and granular. Fermentation, grinding, and cooking it with a greater proportion of water all contribute toward its appealing creaminess. Sorghum porridge. Sorghum as a grain is even more obscure in the United States than millet. I bought some for sorghum beer making and have fallen in love with it as a porridge. To make acida, I coarsely mill the sorghum into a bowl and ferment it in the Sudanese method, known as ajin. To do this, moisten the flour with a small amount of dechlorinated water. Add water to the flour just a bit at a time, mix, and add a little more water until there are no more dry patches in the flour. Cover with a cloth and ferment 1 or 2 days, stirring periodically. When you are ready to make porridge, boil about 3 times as much water as your volume of ajin. Add ajin and stir. Keep stirring as it cooks and thickens. I usually cook it for about 15 minutes. Experienced women have a simple test to check if the acida is cooked, explains Dirar. A woman wets her finger and presses it on the mass of acida. A well-done porridge bounces back on withdrawal of the finger, which comes off clean. An acida that is not well-cooked lacks resilience and sticks to the finger. A half-done acida also falls apart and partly dissolves when water is added to it. I like to make a batch of acida in the morning, eat some hot, and pour the rest onto a plate to cool and solidify, then eat it all day long with whatever else I prepare. Eating solidified porridge reminds me how similar porridge is to bread. In fact, in the Sudan, where sorghum is a daily staple, the word kisra was used to describe porridge. Then, as flatbread spread as a way of eating sorghum, the flatbread became known as kisra rahifa. By 1992, when Hamid Dirar published his Indigenous Fermented Foods of the Sudan, kisra had come to refer almost exclusively to sorghum flatbreads. The influence of the city culture is spreading to the villages very rapidly, and it is clearly seen that the stiff porridge is gradually being called acida and the thin bread, kisra. Rice congee. The porridge of Chinese cuisine is called congee. Like other porridges, congee is creamier and more digestible if the grain is soaked beforehand. In addition to rice, congee can also be made from millet, spelt, and other grains. The best way to make congee is as I described making whole groat oatmeal earlier. Soak the grain. Then bring the water and grain to a boil and leave it gently cooking all night on a trivet atop a damped-down wood stove, radiator, or other gentle heat source. An alternative, practiced every day for decades by my recently departed friend Dr. Crazy Owl, and great for camping trips, is to combine grain and boiling water in a preheated thermos and leave it overnight. The rice congee is still hot in the morning, thoroughly cooked, and ready to eat. Crazy Owl sang the healing virtues of rice congee, especially for the infirm and frail. He was so devoted to a daily rice congee practice that when he abandoned it and started asking for fruit smoothies instead, it lent credence to his announcement that, "I am ready to go." 2 weeks later, he was, indeed, gone. Congee is widely used as a healing food. According to Paul Pitchford, author of Healing with Whole Foods, congee is easily digested and assimilated, tonifies the blood and the qi energy, harmonizes the digestion, and is demulcent, cooling and nourishing. Vegetables, beans, fruits, miso, and other fermented condiments, meat stock, and medicinal herbs can be added for flavor and specific therapeutic effects. Congee is sometimes referred to as a soup rather than as a porridge, and indeed it is typically soupy. Rather than a homogeneous texture, however, it is a starchy suspension with grains of rice floating in it. 1 part grain to 6 parts water is a rough proportion, but you could use less or more. It is better to use too much water than too little, advises Paul Pitchford. It is said that the longer kanji cooks, the more powerful it becomes. Old bread porridge. A great way to use old dry bread is to cook it into porridge. To do so, cut bread into cubes and then soak them in water. Or if the bread is too hard to easily slice, soak it first. Cook in a little water or milk, adding liquid as necessary to achieve the desired porridge consistency. Embellish with savory condiments, miso, shoyu, peanut butter, tahini, hot sauce, and/or sweet ones, jam, maple syrup, honey, sugar. Potato porridge. Finally, we get to starchy tubers. The concept of potato porridge came to me from Jana and Vanda Froberg, Swedish sisters who blog as Porridge Hunters Were Here, and have a book about porridge forthcoming. Mashed potatoes are potato porridge. In the Porridge Hunters recipe, they mash the potatoes in the water they were cooked in, then thicken that up with rye flour and cook a little while. But any creamy mashed potatoes can be thought of as porridge. And you can even pre-ferment the potatoes. Cut them into small cubes and cover with water and/or whey in a bowl or jar. Leave to sit covered for a day or two, then cook. I include this improvisational concept as a segue from grain porridges to the fermentation of starchy tubers because frequently the starchy tubers are prepared in porridge-like ways. Poi. Poi is a Hawaiian ferment of taro, Colocasia esculenta, mashed into a gluey purple paste. Taro is central and sacred to the native people of Hawaii, who call it kalo. Poi made an impression on Captain James Cook, who described it in his earliest report from Hawaii. The only artificial dish we met with was a taro pudding, which, though a disagreeable mess from its sourness, was greedily devoured by the natives. By 1933, a University of Hawaii study reported that other foods are taking the place of this ancient standby. Nevertheless, poi has endured. As Hawaiian culture and language continue their steady resurgence begun in the 1970s, an awareness of the importance of kalo is reemerging as well, reported Maui Magazine in 2007. The part of the taro plant processed into poi is the swollen underground base of the stem, known as the corm. The taro corm must be thoroughly cooked by steaming or boiling in order to neutralize calcium oxalate crystals, which feel like eating fiberglass if consumed uncooked, reports my friend Jay Bost. Once cooked, the corm's skin is scraped off and, while still warm, the starchy flesh is mashed into a paste, adding water as necessary. Traditionally, the cooked taro is mashed against a special wooden board using a heavy stone pounding tool, known as a pohaku kui ai. You can mash by hand, using either a mortar and pestle or a potato masher or in a food processor. Try to find and crush any lumps in order to get the paste as smooth as possible. To ferment, simply pack the mashed taro into a ceramic or glass bowl or crock. Leave some room in the vessel for expansion, as the poi will expand as it ferments. Ferment it for a few days at room temperature. Typically, no culture is introduced unless you have mature poi, a little of which can be added to the fresh mashed taro. If white surface mold develops, mix it right in. It remains a bit of a mystery to me how the ferment starts so quickly in a cooked substrate without adding any raw adjuncts to get it going. However, somehow it does. Two bacteriologists at the University of Hawaii published a 5-year study of poi fermentation in 1933. They performed bacterial cell counts on uncooked taro corms, on the skins immediately after cooking, on peeled cooked taro, and on fermented poi. The organisms responsible for the fermentation were abundant on the steamed taro corms immediately following heating, they reported. Grinding of the crushed corms aids in breaking the bacterial clumps or colonies on the corms, and therefore makes it possible not only increase in numbers of original organisms, but also their distribution rather homogeneously throughout the fresh poi. As with any ferment, some people prefer poi mild after just a day or two, while others prefer the more sour flavor that develops as more days pass. In Hawaiian temperatures, 3 to 5 days is the normal range. In cooler places, it may take longer. The color and texture of the poi also change as fermentation proceeds. Taste each day to evaluate. Poi can be prepared thinner or thicker. The consistency of poi is usually described by the number of fingers it takes to eat. most sources concur that two-finger poi is the ideal. Very thick poi is one finger, while runny poi is three finger. But ultimately, it's a question of what texture you like. Simply add water and mash until you reach that consistency. For slow fermentation and long storage, the poi is made as thick as possible and then thinned by adding water as needed. Poi has its own unique healing properties. Pamela Day credits poi with saving the life of her daughter, who suffers from multiple food allergies and as an infant could not tolerate breast milk or soy formula, but did eat poi. Poi shows promise for use in infants with allergies or failure to thrive, reports the journal Nutrition and Clinical Care. In addition, research suggests that poi may have both anti-tumor and immune-stimulating effects.